very much. I was here on the 21st of June, the book has gone into reprint actually this week. Thank you. And thankfully, none of my family objected to any of the poems, so none of the copies had to be pulled for anything.
Think of all the publicity
you
could have got.
Yeah, oh god, I know. Think of all the publicity. Yeah. Will the second run be 50 as well? Oh, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I'll try this one. Planting. 1955. The trees are scurvy now. In your youth and courting a neighbour farmer's daughter, you chose your spot, had a word with your parents, got the blessing to build. But first you planted beyond the haggard, away from your parents' privacy, a myriad of beech and birch and fruit, several varieties your mother advised you needed, and oak for your grandchildren, trees a woman could look out to, admire colour in four seasons, trees that shed at different times, the first blossoms shot out for your bride to come home to. They grew fruit as your fruit grew up under them, climbed them, plucked the apples, pears and plums, and underneath gooseberry bushes that kept the herd away from the lawn. Your offspring built hideouts and treehouses, cut branches to build go-karts, concoctions of wheelie things, inventors things, playtime things. When the kitchen grew dark, you gave in to nagging and nipped and cut, your sons helping some of the higher reaches, your daughters delighting in shouting, "Timber!" down below. Still, there were threats of lightning, but thank God, and please God, it has not struck. Now, after you have been lowered into the same mother earth that grew them, we stand under your trees, drink, smoke, nibble sandwiches, reminisce, laugh, and cry, your children waking you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Noel. Next, Mr. Louis Mulcahy.
Thanks very much. A long time ago, I worked with Sperius Radio, that should be their television department. That's Swedish television. Stockholm. Hello, Mr. Heaney. Can you hear me, Mr. Yates? I can feel this table shifting. Why don't you answer, Mr. Yates? You were a dab hand at the answers when you sat this side, Mr. Yates. Thank you, Mr. Heaney. Sure, he always was stuck up, always muttering to himself, only speaking to the women or the Irish Times and Senate. What's that you're saying, Seamus? Well, it's just you might not know that you are not the first since Mr. Yates in 23 to have gone out from Ireland to softly tread the stage of Stockholm's Opera House. I was there before you, 40 years ago, when Solzhenitsyn didn't show, for Russia wouldn't let him back if he came out. If I'd read my poems, I might have got the prize in place of Alexander. You'd never know. But Seamus, even if they called my name, I couldn't come. I was too busy scanning all the nodding heads of state. As cloaked by Alfred's bust, I panned my TV camera from that stage you later graced. This is one, it was written first in Irish and then translated, and my translations are always sort of a parallel poem, not quite direct. I'll read the English first. Lapsed. Lapsed. It rankles less now under the salve of years, but still grates a little that my early leap from their faith, sprung on churning thought, was reduced by vengeful denigration to lapsed. Dulta ileg, dulta ileg, diltus I vocal capta den ein gno, con ornanimica alut, inunad, Machnabuk Vishnu Kalman O'Croge, Dr. Dolta Ileg.
And next, we have Eileen Sheehan. Sorry, Mr. Rathbogel.
Thank you. I'm speaking of the introduction for this from Pat Hatter. Because this poem is about the kind of man who writes the wonderful love poem, holds it in reserve, and every woman he meets he presents to us for love. Calling his bluff. On a Monday he met a red-headed woman walking on the road, her skin saturated from the falling rain, so he offered her the shelter of his coat. On the Wednesday he met a fair-haired woman, her skin flayed raw by the sun's extending rays. He offered her his coat to mind her from the heat. On the Sunday he met a black-haired woman right in his path. There was no rain, and the air was neither cold nor hot, but he offered her his coat in case of a sudden rip in the clouds or an unforeseen rush of rising heat. But she said, "This garment reeks of rain and a redhead's recent gratitude. This cloth is rife with sweat and the skin cells from a blonde. Don't offer me this ragged coat, but meet me on the moonlight, be naked on the road."
Mr. John Davies.
This is quite densely written, but it's not my fault because it's somebody else's poem. This is after the Italian of Eugenio Montale. It's the second half of a poem called The Eel, and The Eel is one of Montale's poems that's translated by a lot of poets. But for some reason, it's a poem in two halves. They rarely translate the second half. They only translate the first half, as if that's the poem. So I thought, well, the second half of the poem is kind of sulking there, so I thought I'd do it very well. I kept the formal structures as well as I could. I've given it the title from the first two words of the original, Iveni, after Eugenio Montale. Iveni have confused you with the fox. It will be due to that magnificent jump, for the flying in your step joins as much as separates. It agitates each lump of grit in the stony path. Your terrace, the streets near the Cotolengo meadow, the birch tree that quivers at the mere trace of me, happy, humble, rotted hollow. Or perhaps only for the luminous wave that oscillates from your almond eyes, for the shrewdness of your feigned surprise, for the hurt of your childish touch, torn feathers so easily loosened with love. If men have confused you with a mere carnivore, to the treacherous savant beneath fern, but, and strangely, never likened you more to that cunning fish, torpedo certain. It is possible that the mindful blind did not discern the blossomed wings sprouting from your shoulders, and that the mindful blind did not interpret the omen glowing in your forehead, the groove that I have scratched there in blood, cross, chrism, enchantment, death, a prayer meaning both perdition and salvation. If they did not have the skill to reckon you between a weasel or a woman, then with whom can I share the revelation? Where shall I bury the gold I sweat out, metalled in the cold furnace of my heart, when, turning from the high stairs, you depart?
you, John. Next up, could we have, I've got Chick of Destiny in our current five-word reigning champion, Trisha Walsh.
Thank you, Paul. I normally read myself off by heart, but this day is to make an honorary exception. And this one's called The Expatriate. Straight to freedom closing in, on schoolgirl life I once ignored. I'm just calm in the classroom, potentially writing, but write no more. I write and fight and real escape from imagination and a poisonous dream. English composition will be compromised. I fail the other, yet I am unable to perfect art and butcher time, nor on the area of a schoolroom table. How I feel am I from false moral rages? I've played a problem and false rages. My words on fire meant my life's escape. My faults I know are all on tape. Resolutions in writing form. There's something strange about being born. Woo!
Thank you, Patricia. Next up we have Harriet Abdullah.
The beginning of another short story, so it's kind of the first draft to me. And it's called The Young Priest. The young priest paced up and down the corridor with an expectant air. Where was he being transferred? What decision were the bishop and the senior priest making in there? The heavy wooden door disclosed no secret. He glanced down the empty corridor, and his footsteps echoed with eerie reverence as he stepped towards the wrought iron window. Outside, the last autumn leaves were swaying gently on the barren trees. A light gust would make them quiver lightly. One or two fell to the ground, yellowed and freckled with decay. The yard was in dire need of raking. The ground was carpeted with a putrefied layer of brown and yellow, dead vegetation, always molded itself with a little imagination. Sometimes the dead leaves looked like crumpled up dead birds or mice. Donahue always stepped carefully outside. He couldn't stand the possibility of hearing flesh and bone stepped under the sole of his shoe. The mere thought made him sick. The priest didn't hear Murphy, the old church keeper, as he noiselessly limped past him. The old man coughed hoarsely, his shriveled lungs struggling for air. This startled the priest out of his daydream. He nodded, and the keeper nodded back and limped on. A relationship founded on 3 years of daily nodding, that Donahue thought would inevitably lead to that one unforgettable last nod upon his departure. The man was pushing 70 and smoking at least a pack a day. Donahue thought about Father Matthew performing mass at Mr. Murphy's funeral. A very courteous man. He lived an honest life and had a good nod for everyone he met. That made him smart, but he instantly felt guilty. The heavy door creaked behind him. It only took two hours for Father Matthew and Bishop Devlin to come to a decision. Father Matthew asked him to step inside. The bishop was standing behind his desk, leafing through a golden ledger almost ceremoniously. Everything was ceremonious about the bishop's demeanor. Some of you couldn't help but think if the bishop was ceremonious when he went to the toilet. It was a funny image, but he didn't smirk to son. The bishop looked up with that familiar light disdain in his eyes just as Father Matthew sat down. The old priest shuffled in the seat. Donahue was not invited to sit. Father Donahue, you have been with us for 3 years. Yes, Bishop. That was not a question, Desmond said, mildly annoyed. Myself and Father Matthew have been debating over your transfer for the last 2 hours, as you well know. Desmond paused. That was a question, Father Donahue. Donahue bowed his head lower. Apologies, Bishop. Yes, Bishop. You could try to be more grateful. Anyway, you have finally made a decision, and I'm sure you'll be very pleased. Father Matthew turned towards Donahue with that faintest hint of a smile on his lips. The young priest didn't know if it was time to talk again, so he glanced at Father Matthew with questioning eyes. We are transferring you to St. Mary's the Immaculate. You'll be under the supervision of Father Michael Riley. Thank you, Bishop. Thank you, Father. Donahue nodded, his sweaty hands clasped behind his back. You may leave us now. Donahue walked out, pulling the door behind him in a daze. Halfway down the corridor, he heard the door open and close again. Father Matthew emerged and walked in the opposite direction with quick economic footsteps. In the garden, Mr. Murphy was raking the leaves, his face strained with exhaustion and age. A cigarette was tightly lodged between his lips. Smoke tendrils revolved around his bald head like a translucent wave. The nod wasn't necessary this time, since the keeper had his back to him. The young priest glanced at the dead leaves and the puddles on the footpath ahead. He was deciding on a trajectory. He then glanced back to Mr. Murphy just in case the old man had turned and a fresh nod was necessary. He was still raking with his back toward. The smoke strands darkened into black tendrils. Slowly they encircled Murphy's head like a dark turban. Donahue's eyes widened until his sockets felt too tight. As the smoke drifted higher, emerging into a shape almost like imposing black wings, Donahue's throat tightened. The wings flapped in the breeze like a dismembered eagle. The priest parted his lips intending to call out to Mr. Murphy, but his voice froze. Fear rose in his heart. He suddenly didn't want Murphy to turn. His heart cowered. The strong breeze prickled the hairs on the back of his neck. He took one step backward away from Murphy and then stopped. The breeze blew past him stronger again. The immaterial wings dispelled in the afternoon wind. He found himself staring at the space above Murphy's head. He clutched his cross and rubbed it between his thumb and forefinger. Following the trajectory back to his room, he said something to my father.
This is something I've been fooling around with there recently. It's a poem that imagines God as a computer programmer, female computer programmer, and the human race, of course, as a virus. If only she could bring herself to start once more, but then she's been through it so often. Can she even remember which version this is? There's been so many, each with the same indelible flaw. Though she'd been so careful this time, so patient with the unmutated system architecture, so determined to avoid a recurrence of the bug. She took month after month of moulding each module to the highest conceptual integrity, shaping and reshaping the control hierarchies, structural partitioning. And all this before the lonely 40 years of coding. Finally, there came the day of execution. It compiled and things started happening. The expected epic bang and cooling. The slow eternities of studying nebulae collapse in form. She saw them nurse stars, observed vast pebbles of debris cohering in them. Countless round bodies, countless masses, constitutions, metallic, freezing, gassy, till the special one spun in its usual dance. She sat through the stubborn centuries of terraforming. He is always headed and start with the life forms. Then action. Fresh things bifurcating from only slightly less fresh things. Her monitors grew clogged with growing things. She watched it all with mingled nervousness and pride. The thought had barely tickled her mind that this time she'd got it, that this time, touch wood, she finally got it. When they were again, the apes of consciousness. The first isolated heart sent their black spires rising from copse and crag. Forests were rolled back like carpet, the bare fields stripped and striped under the plough. Cities zitted the tender plains. The rivers whose vectors she so carefully plotted were deflected by wills not hers, as each continent tried on different empires, chafingly, impatiently, like overweight frights in a fitting room. Congeous upon congeous of slave sweat, heresiarchs, castles were gauntlets on each hill's brow. So the architect turned once more wearily to the debugging process. She began as usual with trace statements, scanning the printouts with toric concentration, tedious to hunt for the root rotten variables among the fields of rippling code, tedious and futile. But she has grown more beautiful with each past season of searching, leaner. Her pale neck, it seems, somehow longer now. Her skin more textured and more delicious cream. She does not know this. She walked through the execution process again and again, her mind wandering that invisible labyrinth as she closed slowly in her logic. She could almost smell it. Furtive, fecal, but always somehow around the next corner. She brought semantic checkers to bear on the source code, statically analysing it for all generic likely and previous noisy problems. Over the years, her eyes have grown browner, their hazel less hazed, more nut brown. though they still fade to mint around the rims of the irises, still have those flecks of almost yellow. She targeted the problem with other debuggers. Abraham, Mosaic 4.0, Elijah, studiedly did nothing, just filing her nails while trying not to wait for inspiration to mug her of her predicament. Deploy the last and desperate messianic patch, nada, zilch, shagol. All the while, of course, her error has spread itself, corrupting sector after unrelated sector, its depredations shocking her screens. God wills it, defenestration, total war, the weak force, styrofoam cups, rainbow herbicides, closed circuit, infomercials, spray on tan and weaponized botulism. So the architect begins the dream of winter, of just wiping the discs and starting again, with a screen clean as her own mind was at the beginning, all those versions ago. As the frozen sea I saw once off the northern peninsula, those ruffled infinities that stretched in every direction outwards from the mount we stood on, a blankness that half bled into the horizon's lowest shimmering strip and then somehow went beyond it, a limitless crispness that would brook no fall or alteration in the February glare, featureless beyond the occasional fluffy smear, almost treeless, blinding.
We have about 12 minutes left for about five people, so literally if we can keep it for 2 minutes, 2 minutes each, if we can get your song done in 2 minutes, yeah?
Okay.
Great. We're going to have a song quickly and then four votes to win the night. Russell Donovan. Oh, sorry, Richard Walsh.
Are you going to sing fast? No, you know you're old when you can't remember the page number anymore. Sean Lucy always said,
the young poet always knows the page number.
Very old.
And the old poet can't even remember the title of the poem. But anyway, the singing Bichon. My dog sings arias, but only to me. Mahler's Kindertoten Lieder he knows imperfectly. The In Paradisum of Fauré's Requiem he renders with a strong nasal strain. He can't quite reach all the notes of Purcell's The Pliant, but hey, he's just a dog. He began to sing when I began to ignore him. Neither of us can stand the other's company. When he shakes his Bichon curls, doggy whisks, tinged with bitter fermentation, assault the upper reaches of my nostrils. His piss perfumes the corners of my living room with a pungency made worse by the addition, without obliteration, of the mop bucket's ammonia-based floor fluid. I can't stand him because he smells. He can't stand me because I'm impervious to his plaintive, glistening eyes. Regularly, we each need to elude the secret inner lives of our separate solitudes. I by listening to my music, he by stepping outdoors to sniff the arses of other dogs, or to beg attention of passing children. After I ignored his whines to be let outside, he learned to sing. That first night I could not avoid paying attention to his original interpretation of Raphael Courtauld's Creep, Creep, Softly Creep. I released him, he arse-sniffed. The following night I ignored his Courtauld and he sang something by Durafle. I once tried to arrange a soiree where I planned to accompany him on cello, my living room to Bijou for the pianoforte, but with the house full of guests he had no solitude to escape and no need to sing. He doesn't know I know he sings Rufus Wainwright when he thinks I'm not around. Smelly bastard.
Thank you, Pat. Next, Rosa Donovan.
Another untitled poem. It's, why do I push myself so hard, even when I know it's written off? I want to be a better man, and destiny seems to know the plan. I am trapped within my head, spending far too much time in bed. The tears I've cried, and thoughts deprived, from lovers lost to friends gained. These sheets so tired and sustained. I build myself up for my next fall, and lie waiting for a call that will never come. These tired eyes that look disguised for answers, questions unknown. So let me rest upon your breast, where you keep time while I curse this rhyme.
Thank you, Ross. And next we have Pascal McDonald.
A quatrain to my hero, Roy Keane, is called Corkeoch. It's Misha Corkeoch, as ballad amucked. It's Misha Corkeoch, as got maddens got knocked. It's Misha Corkeoch, and winkins McCree. It's Misha Corkeoch, as broke Nelly. Just one quick one there. How oft men had said, jesting yet true, and pigs will fly, then in 2009, swine flu.
Special court depression after August. And finally for the evening, which is a fantastic open mic, birthday, Mr. Alan Tetley.
Thanks, much as usual, sonnets, which is my favourite form. I was lucky enough to have a couple of poems in the latest Irish pages, that great Belfast journal. All right, and it's an Irish poem called the Nua Vajdri, and an English translation as well, but both sonnets are quite short. Na Nua Vajdri. Bishe Kakilor Lesh Tasigot Na Nua Vajdri. Nirvegar Chasigot Gahareha, Kahavshin and Tolish the Shomer City, Avis Banrilev Litrach and Akila Potter, Nu Rela Erskil Bibu to Egan or son Darlak Vahish. Bahakli na shin yo shah and tavish dig a mop, of the letter yap mugur vinting e, on cligan tariv, or lahimil shli, on tuirid or elas and ehil harav, on bail oma kank a milish lefa, on dwilla real gan ho, visiko karav and tresha beme, eg munshilu, shagal, nitsiantoin se schnachter, tuir vagarach of the shiriko, reela ruila de kuning and yawn danach so, na nayor, a machnum le squidini, and os caider of natinil le tlu. Daimid dirach na daimachta, sor a chuig an lasser as. Yindan chienshe te eeske, ur a gurnanach, crown is chas. It's a kind of an answer to, I think it's Auden's point about the old masters. They were never wrong, the old masters. I would put something like that. So this is about the new masters, really. They weren't bad, that bad either, you know, the new masters. Not that concerned they weren't with a certain slant of light in a drawing room, or a young girl with an earring reading a letter or the Bible because it was convenient or right. They preferred the innards, the glut and the gut of things, a bull's head twisted sideways, a melted watch in heat. The voice that spoke just rubbish, the bonk and bling of commercial trash, all that grooves and grates about Chagall's triangle in the snow, the rip of Munch's shriek in and out about the twirling of the shiriko's loops, the cooning splashing colours in troughs and peaks, sinking with brushes and making the boring new. Of the straight timber of humanity, they made a whirling cup, all bent and curled and knotted, and beautifully fucked.